Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor with the Mises Institute. And we're back this time to talk a little bit more about foreign policy. Last time, we talked about China quite a bit and China's ability to project military power and to really compete with the United States in that sphere. And there was quite a bit of interest for that topic. So this time, I want to return to foreign policy a little, but also take a more general view and really to look at what sort of overlap there might be between some of the main thoughts in international relations, the work being done there, and how it could be a resource to laissez-faire and anti-interventionist libertarian types, free market people. And most of this work is done by political scientists. I often hear among free market people and some libertarians, they like to mock political scientists. A lot of them are economists, and I guess they think this is a superior discipline. And however, a lot of these people seem to be unaware or don't care or don't think it's important that most of the work in international relations, much of which is good research on historical cases of conflicts between states and so on, that's coming out from political science departments. That's being done by political scientists. And so some of the, most of the scholars we'll look at today are in fact political scientists, places like MIT or the University of Chicago and so on, that are really providing a lot of the good work in evaluating states and state power and conflicts between states, and also a lot of good work on evaluating the American strategy. And is this maximalist American strategy of spending trillions of dollars on occupying foreign countries and so on, is that a good idea? Is that counterproductive? And I think there is some good research on that. And certainly the anti-interventionist position has its own nice long pedigree in the West here. Looking at, for example, the old classical liberals from the 19th century, such as Herbert Spencer, Richard Cobden, both of which were very anti-interventionist in their foreign policy. And so I think we can build on what they were doing. But to do that, I think it would require some familiarity with the research that it already exists and to see how we can use that to our own advantage. And to discuss that a little bit today, I've brought on, as usual, Tho Bishop, who's our associate editor at the Mises Institute. And also I brought on Zachary Yost. Now, Zachary, we've talked to before here on Radio Rothbard on an earlier episode when we just talked about our local experiences with COVID lockdowns and restrictions, just to provide something of a look at how things were different in different places in the country. But it also happens to be that Zachary's background is in international relations, political science, and he's also currently a Marcellus Policy Fellow at the John Quincy Adams Society, and their focus is foreign policy. So I've brought Zachary on also to talk a little bit about new books, new strains of thought, and some good research, I think, that can be helpful. So hi, guys. How you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for having me on again, guys.
Doing great. And I'm excited for this episode because, you know, I'm kind of coming from this in a similar position where I think most of the audience will be. I'm someone that, you know, may have I've been too dismissive of political science in the past, and it's really only been the last year or so where I've been reading, you know, more deeply, and obviously very, you know, not nearly as much within the kind of the former international relations sphere as you guys. And so I'm looking forward to this as kind of a layperson, you know, making some notes on my next Amazon purchases myself.
Well, and so to start, let's just really identify, I think, some of the basic schools of thought. Now, historically, in the field of international relations, there's been a variety of schools of thought. There's been rationalism. There's been specifically Marxist ideas of international relations. Although I think really what it comes down to today are two types of thinking on this, and this is what we'll end up mostly discussing, is there's ideas of liberalism and in practice, really liberal hegemony. And this shouldn't be really confused with 19th century laissez-faire liberalism. This is its own thing that we call liberalism. And it's not even really necessarily related to American modern day liberalism, such as the ideology of the welfare state and all of that. This is foreign policy liberalism. So don't get confused when we're talking about that. And probably the ascendant idea of thinking there is liberal hegemony. And this is an idea that the United States and other liberal nations should really flex their muscles internationally to either force or encourage through various means all regimes to embrace liberal democracy. And if they don't, to perhaps punish them, maybe, or to intervene, to provide regime change and so on. And then I think the other field, the other school of thought in IR that I certainly wouldn't describe as ascendant, but nevertheless continues to have some influence and has a long historical pedigree, is realism. And we've got various schools of that. There's also neorealism, which differs a little bit. And what we'll discuss a little bit, I think, are our ideas of what's called defensive realism and offensive realism. And we'll talk about some of the theorists around that. And I'll just throw out there right off the bat that my particular preference, I think the school of thought that is most useful and I think has the most potential for living side by side with the laissez-faire position and being useful as a resource is defensive realism. And I think if we look into the theory behind that and the assumptions behind that school of thought in IR, it can really help us to refine our thought on international relations. And that school can also provide us with a lot of good research and examples that have been done over the years to show that states behave in a certain way that I think backs up our efforts toward really scaling back foreign military aggression in the world today. Now, so part of the reason I brought Zachary on is that he and I have talked a lot about these realists. And so perhaps, Zachary, you could maybe just kind of come right in and tell us a little bit about the Great Delusion and Mearsheimer's critique of liberal hegemony. And I think that would kind of get the listener up to speed on this school of thought, this bad school of thought, in my opinion, that's pretty influential and has done a lot of damage. And that's perhaps maybe the number one thing we need to fight against right now.
Sure. And I think The Great Delusion by John Mearsheimer would be a really great intro text for interested listeners who just kind of aren't too familiar with international relations as a science. Now, what Mearsheimer does is he breaks down liberalism. And I appreciate that he notes that there are two, he separates liberalism into two veins. And one is basically the Hayekian, I think is who he identifies, school of liberal thought, kind of hands-off, laissez-faire, negative rights. And then there's the more universalist liberals. And for them, human rights are kind of non-negotiable in their conception of them as being the same in all times, in all places, and that if human rights in their conception of them are being undermined anywhere on the planet, well, this could lead to kind of power vacuums and a lack of order, et cetera, that can lead to war and conflict. So there's kind of a two sides to the universalist liberal coin. The one being we have to defend human rights, our conception of them around the globe. It's our moral duty. And as we can get to, it's a moral crusade. For them, foreign policy is very morally driven, but not in a good way, I would argue. On the other side of the coin, they also tend to believe in what's called democratic peace theory, that liberal democracies don't fight each other. So if we get the whole world to be full of liberal democracies, peace and happiness will reign. And Mearsheimer in this book goes through and just kind of explains why this way of thinking is a recipe for kind of endless war and military intervention and militarism that is made possible by the United States being so strong and secure. If the United States was not as safe and secure as it is today, we would not be able to go off on all these kind of crazy crusades to try and nation build. And yeah, so I'd say it's a good place to start to understand kind of what we're up against, the mindset of the people who want the United States to be militarily involved kind of everywhere and always.
Well, and not only, of course, is this problematic in a certain moral sense, right, where the U.S. is just going to run around the world and invade countries, start to assert itself, really project its power on countries that don't want it, but it seems to often just not work very well. And it seems that Mearsheimer puts up a couple of reasons why this works, one of which is nationalism. And what's his point about nationalism? Like, why is that a problem for liberalism?
Yeah, so Mearsheimer, I believe several times in the book, and he said it a million times elsewhere, says that nationalism is actually the most powerful kind of force on the planet. Nationalism has, one might say, has increased over the past few hundred years from where it was before, as states have kind of centralized and things like that. And it serves as a kind of unifying force for whatever people group, and people want to rule themselves, basically, through whether that's through a communist dictatorship in China or, you know, our kind of crumbling system of constitutional democracy here in the United States. People want to believe that they're kind of in charge and in control. So people don't take kindly to other people, namely usually the United States, coming in and trying to, you know, reorder their society as the outsiders see fit. And it might be a helpful exercise for listeners to just think of the United States, how even people we consider kind of leftist and, you know, to some degree, oh, they're unpatriotic or something. Actually, the United States is a rabidly nationalist country. And you can think back to the aftermath of the 2016 election, where everyone was freaking out about, oh my God, the Russians have intervened in our election. How dare they? You know, the world is ending. This is an outrage. You know, investigations for years on end. We ourselves can look at how our country reacts to even the possibility of outside interference by another state. And now just apply that to any other state on the globe, which is increasingly becoming more and more nationalist. And you'll see why it proves to be such an obstacle to, you know, the open, you know, welcome parade, you know, reception of U.S. central planners who've gone to reconstruct Afghanistan or wherever.
Well, and I think, of course, that Mearsheimer's critique of liberal hegemony is the best part of the book. And in his review of the book, which we have on Mises.org by David Gordon, he agrees as well. But like me, then, when you start to get into some of the policy prescriptions that Mearsheimer has, I think he starts to get into trouble. And this, I think, goes back to his brand of realism. Because being a realist, he's pretty good at understanding that other states are likely to want to preserve themselves from any sort of foreign aggression, and that the United States is going to run into a lot of problems with that, even if it's claiming to bring all sorts of benefits through regime change and so on. But being an offensive realist, then he goes down this road of assuming that China, for example, is going to want to maximize its power globally, and will not stop until it can do so. And that states in general, they don't ever really reach a point where they're satisfied with the amount of security they have, and that they tend to really judge the risks of further expansion and aggression as fairly low. And so there's a lot of talk in there about, well, the U.S. is going to need to really intervene in East Asia and do a lot of balancing, a lot of explicit military intervention in the region in order to ensure that China doesn't grow into a larger and larger sort of hegemon. I myself, I tend to go more with the defensive realism position, which is that states in many cases are actually satisfied, well, most cases, and that there's only a few exceptions that we can point to, exceptions being like Napoleon and Hitler, which are actually really unusual cases that you rarely see, and that most states actually, should they reach a point where they're satisfied with the amount of security they have, that they feel they can have self-preservation and security, that they become in many ways status quo powers. And we saw a lot of this in the 19th century with large major global powers like Russia and Prussia and some other states as well. During that period, they had the opportunity to grow into much larger hegemons and chose not to do so because they saw real risks there. And I don't know what your opinion is on that, Zachary. I just invited you on and I figured you would have an opinion. But I don't know what your thoughts are on this idea, right? Will we forever be locked in this idea where every country will constantly seek new ways to maximize its power? Or can states reach some sort of equilibrium point where, with some exceptions, they could perhaps find a situation where they'll be able to live side by side with some major powers, but that not every state is constantly going to be scheming to become some sort of hegemonic power?
So I am more on the offensive realism side, but with the caveat that I think Mearsheimer is mostly referring to great powers. So in a way, from Mearsheimer's perspective, lots of states are kind of irrelevant, like Bolivia or, you know, Grenada. They're so, as it were, unpowerful, so weak that they're kind of not even players in the game. And it's more states that have a realistic chance at becoming a hegemon, kind of the top dog in the dog park, as it were. And so I do, in a way, subscribe more to Mearsheimer's kind of tragedy of great power politics, that there's always going to be this security competition. But for various reasons, I think that for the foreseeable future, certainly for my lifetime, I do not think we're going to see any kind of great power conflict like we saw, you know, in the World Wars or the Cold War, the biggest being global demographics. Every country that has a shot at being a great power is going to have a lot of demographic trouble down the road, where they're going to have a lot of old people and not many working age people to support those old people. So I think that's going to kind of sap a lot of potential war-making resources. And I loved your guys' conversation previously about China. I thought you hit on so many correct points, whereas like I do think were factors very different in China than they are in reality, then potentially I could be concerned. But I'm less concerned, not because I do not think that the Chinese government is operating under Mearsheimer's framework. I do think they think like Mearsheimer thinks they do. I think their actual capacities for acting on that are decreasing as time goes by. And Mearsheimer actually, at a conference, he basically said something quite similar, where he said, if I think the author's name is Gordon Chang, wrote a book called The Coming Collapse of China or something like that. And he's like, if Chang is correct and China has all these problems, well, then they're obviously not going to rise and we're not going to have this kind of big balancing struggle, as it were.
I think this entire conversation right here ties into where there's a lot of great complements between, say, you know, kind of Rothbardian political theory, Austrian economics, and the contribution, you know, in ways that they can contribute to developing out some of the this realist tradition. Because, you know, when we're talking about, you know, these states interacting within foreign international affairs, you know, where we're talking about an anarchistic environment, you know, there where you do not have, you know, you know, strong, you know, international governing institutions. And so a lot of kind of the Rothbardian concepts about how governing entities arise and interact with each other, or market forces interact within an anarcho-capitalist society, you know, there's some parallels here with some of the conversations going on within this international relations literature. And then, of course, you know, the economics aspect of any sort of broader analysis, whether it comes to, you know, you see inefficiencies in history, you see inefficiencies with international, you know, relations literature, you know, it's kind of, they're buying kind of the mainstream zeitgeist on this sort of stuff, where, you know, some Austrian critiques about, you know, again, like the true economic strength of China, you know, that would obviously play into some significant roles here. And so again, hopefully this, you know, highlighting some of the literature here that we, you know, some of our audience can dive into further, you know, we might have all sorts of interesting connections that could be made from people with this sort of, you know, Austro-libertarian background.
Well, I certainly agree. And one example that pops to mind right away, that maybe some listeners are already familiar with for mocking, is Paul Samuelson's textbook that apparently is like 15 editions or something. For like half the editions, he had like a chart and then it switched to a graph or something, predicting that the Soviet GDP, the Soviet economy, was going to surpass that of the United States. And he every edition, he just like kept moving forward the date that would happen and everything, right up until like literally like the Soviet Union completely collapsed and everything. And it's like, well, with economists like these running around, of course people are concerned, like, oh my God, the Soviet Union is such a threat, you know, rather than, you know, I'm pretty sure like Mises and people like that knew from the beginning, well, this project isn't going to last indefinitely because of all these structural economic problems, you know, no prices, things like that, that it's going to not last too long. They're not this kind of powerhouse juggernaut that we need to be fearful of.
Well, and before we go back to some of the critiques there about, you know, kind of, you know, neoliberalism or the liberal traditions of foreign policy, you know, it's interesting because a lot of that, you know, a lot of the conversations about, you know, again, even neoliberalism itself is a term that gets thrown around sloppily. I know that we have several articles on it, many of them written by Ryan. You know, but it's also those institutions that are not simply the UN, but, you know, the World Bank and IMF and again, you know, these institutions kind of built upon, you know, some of the fallacies of these 20th century economic traditions. Mm-hmm. And again, so it's not a surprise when we see the stresses of bad central bank policy, you know, the over-exaggeration about, you know, what development economics really is. You know, within all the failures of, you know, 20th century, you know, economics tradition, you know, this is directly connected to some of the challenges that we're seeing, to some of the assumptions of the neoliberal foreign policy order that has unfortunately guided American policy for far too long.
Well, I think an important point that could be made, too, is that foreign policy, you could make the claim that foreign policy, when we're talking about that, this could include things other than a discussion about security. Right? Foreign policy as an umbrella concept could certainly include trade policy, immigration policy, and just simply relations with other states in a non-military context. But part of foreign policy, of course, would always be security and the issue of the state generally remaining safe from aggression on the part of other states. It's important to note, of course, that states view their own safety as different from the safety of their people in general, right? States don't have a problem with conscripting you and sending you to get blown up if they think that will contribute to the state's safety, even if you don't care if the state is destroyed in the process of a war. Even if you want that state to be destroyed in the process of a war, they can still conscript you and send you off. So those are two different things, of course. However, I think when we are approaching IR theory and foreign policy from the perspective of a laissez-faire free market thinker, where should we go with this and how should we judge them, all these different schools of thought? Because none of them are going to be what you want to be in terms of, yep, they're totally pacifist, they're completely non-interventionist, they're against the idea of states existing and so on. All of these schools of thought for the most part accept that states exist and they interact with each other and that we're working within that world. Now, to describe the world in a certain way as a world of states that interact with each other, that doesn't necessarily mean they even approve of the idea, but that's the system we're working with. And I think then it's important to look at these different schools of thought, evaluate them, and see just how bad are they. And I think that's why it's always good maybe to, if you got to choose a side, be friendlier with the side that's critiquing liberal hegemony and taking a more respectful view of the idea that power in the world should be decentralized in the sense of there's independent regimes and that the international system is anarchic, not really something that should have order imposed on it by the U.S. government, and that there are limits to the U.S. power as well, and that every war is not justified. And I think in practice, then, this ends up having a significant effect on foreign policy in that it's restraining American power. And certainly, I think if we look at how that's practiced today, I think one significant book on this is a book called Restraint by a political scientist at MIT named Barry Posen. And again, Posen's not a laissez-faire guy. Maybe he is on domestic policy. I have no idea. But in terms of foreign policy, this is someone who was a student of Kenneth Waltz, who was basically the founder of defensive realism. He's looking at foreign policy as something that you have to consider in terms of opportunity cost. I don't know if he even uses that term. I can't remember. But he's looking at it in terms of maximizing your military footprint everywhere. Not only is it potentially problematic in terms of just the morals of the situation, but it doesn't even really accomplish its goals. And I think that's a point then that needs to be made. Certainly from the free market perspective, the natural law perspective, you want to point out that military action, unless it's strictly defensive, is immoral and it's wrong. But I also see a lot of value in pointing out that it's counterproductive. And you have to put a lot of building blocks into that, I think. I think, first of all, you need to find yourself a theory where it's not assuming that everyone is pursuing maximum aggression. And I think the realists are better for that, at least the neo-realists, the new kind. Morgenthau, maybe not so much. But yeah, you can't really have a theory that says, yep, states tend toward constant war all the time unless you're having preemptive wars. Then other states are constantly going to be scheming for ways to invade you and destroy you, that there are limiting factors there and appreciating that. But on top of that, you want good research of facts. And this is how IR basically works, right? You've got a working theory, and then you want to look at a bunch of historical examples of wars and foreign policy events. Do they back up the theory? And there's a lot of good work out there, but you have to read it, of course, to be familiar. What are all these foreign policy examples? And back to last week's discussion, we looked a lot at examples of states that were smaller in terms of GDP and overall access to resources that actually were able to project their military power better. The chief examples being in the 19th century, Japan and Britain were able to best China on a number of occasions, even though China was a larger country, larger territory, bigger economy in terms of GDP because it was a huge country. But those smaller countries prevailed. And so we have to look at those examples in order to see if our IR theory is any good. But that takes some actual research and knowledge and really pursuing the examples. And there's just not a lot of work in that, I think, being done right now outside of these people whose job is to do it within the field of international relations. And so I think there's really, in many cases, a gold mine within certain schools of information that can really help us make our points.
And kind of going back to the beginning of your comment, looking at the different schools of thought and you know, they might have some different fundamental principles than, you know, a Rothbardian libertarian might. But if you look at kind of more what policies are they advocating in practice, and if you go way back to the lead up to the Iraq War, realists were the ones who were, you know, on the street corners basically saying, don't invade Iraq. And a bunch of realists, there was a few non-realists, but almost all of them were realists, put together with their own money, I believe it cost $50,000, and they ran a full-page ad in the New York Times saying war with Iraq is not in America's national interest. The only major realist thinker, I think, who kind of thought the Iraq war was a good idea was Henry Kissinger. Basically, every other realist, defensive or offensive, thought the Iraq war was just, was before it even happened, that it would be a complete disaster. So that should maybe endear listeners into checking realist thought out some more.
Yeah, and there seems to be also a completely wrong impression of laissez-faire anti-interventionists, that they all think that everyone would get along perfectly well in the world if the U.S. just got out of the business of any sort of having any sort of military apparatus, or if somehow we were able to push a button and states would magically go away, then everyone would get along. Or some people seem to be under the impression that all anti-interventionists think that every other country in the world has no interest whatsoever in aggression toward the United States. And I've been at events, for example, where I take my usual anti-interventionist position, and then someone after the talk would come up to me and say, you realize that that China wants to maximize its power and is interested in countering U.S. Basically international power in the global world, right? And I mean, yeah, thanks. Thanks for telling me that. I never considered that before. I mean, this idea that just because you're anti-interventionist and you want to scale back military intervention, that you think that Xi Jinping is in the business of charity and only wants to help the world become a better place for everybody, not just the Chinese regime. And so I'm not totally sure how, I guess it's just some things that maybe people have said in chat rooms or comment sections and so on, because I'm certainly not running stuff that says that at Mises.org. But that's just kind of a weird impression, too. And certainly no realist thinks that, right? I mean, they do not take the anti-interventionist position because they think that the rest of the world loves us and that the politicians in the rest of the world, who are no different from American aggressive politicians, that they want to maximize their power given the opportunity. But of course, there's heavy restraints on those countries, and they end up often being just status quo powers.
And this is where realist thought can really help bolster kind of the arguments for even laymen who are, you know, arguing with their friends at the bar or whatever against kind of U.S. primacy, kind of liberal hegemony. Because the realists are always harping on the United States' geostrategic strength. If you listen to, you know, talking heads on Fox News and really every channel these days, you would think America is just like beset with enemies. You know, chaos is about to break in, and you know, if we weren't in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or Somalia or who knows where, you know, we're all toast. Whereas realists point out that there's probably never been a more secure state in the country sense in history. The United States is vast. It has a large, well-educated, wealthy population. We are the strongest state in the entire hemisphere of the globe, in the Western Hemisphere. Our direct neighbors, Canada and Mexico, are weak from a kind of military standpoint. And so is everyone else in the Western Hemisphere. And to the east and west, we have the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, which are vast moats. And I think a lot of people fail to understand the stopping power of water, as it's called. And part of this might be because of really ridiculous kind of like pop culture things, like in one of the Call of Duties that came out when I was in high school, like Russia attacked the eastern coast of the United States and like conquered Washington, D.C. And there's other video games where Russia invades the West Coast and things like that. And it's actually attacking over water is such a complicated task, a complicated undertaking, that it's basically impossible. I mean, theoretically, realists say basically the only threat in the globe that the United States actually has to worry about in terms of outside threats is a Eurasian hegemon, which has never existed. No one power has controlled all of Europe and Asia. And that is generally, you know, the amount of power you would need to project enough force across the ocean to attack the United States. And if there's any people interested in history, just look into what a giant job it was preparing for the D-Day landings. I mean, that was a very short jump, and it was a massive undertaking to attack the United States from the Asian or European mainland. There's no power on Earth that could do that. And so I think people interested in arguing against an aggressive U.S. foreign policy would be well served to dive into realist literature and find out, you know, we're actually really safe and secure. We don't have to go to, you know, the jungle in Africa to keep ourselves safe.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of libertarians are driven by, you know, oh, well, you know, war is bad, which I obviously, you know, fully agree with, right? I mean, you know, no one here is going to be defending the moral virtues of war, but you know, you talk to some people though, and you know, they get concerned about, you know, the international consequences, you know, the humanitarian, you know, costs of not getting involved in somewhere. And so, you know, fleshing out, having a stronger understanding of the actual, you know, dynamics involved in international relations further strengthens the ability for libertarians to make the appeals to a more liberal order, a non-interventionist order in the case of, you know, sort of the foreign policy side of things. You know, because, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, the Austro-libertarian thought at its best is when kind of the utilitarian sort of, you know, values of Mises are aligned with, you know, kind of the natural right sort of views of Rothbard. And, you know, having a broader understanding and appreciation for these different schools of thought can make us more effective in defending, you know, the institutions, the cooperation necessary for, you know, a peaceful libertarian order. And again, we get unfortunately, though, there is an impulse where, you know, everything that is worth saying on a topic can just be derived from, you know, reading very narrowly and extrapolating outwards, you know, from basic principles, you know, being well-read and understanding the realities of these different fields creates again better defenders of liberalism in the Misesian sense.
Well, and I think there's a good example of that from a recent presidential election when Gary Johnson was running as a candidate, and he was infamously asked about Aleppo, the city in Syria. And and Gary's response was, "What is Aleppo?" And so he was roundly mocked for this. And I felt kind of sorry for the guy. He'd been a governor. He'd never shown any interest in foreign policy whatsoever. But I thought that the people who rushed to defend Johnson, not in his position, which he had tended toward an anti-interventionist position, which was all to the good and to his credit. However, defending specifically the idea that he had no idea what was going on in Syria, or at least kind of ostensibly made it look like he didn't have any idea what was going on. And I think it's a safe bet that he's not well informed on the topic. And so a lot of these free market people were saying, oh, I think it's great that he doesn't know anything about Syria or Aleppo or what's going on in the Middle East, because that shows he has no intent to invade those countries and he's more focused on America than on the Middle East. Okay, well, that's great for on a personal level. However, this guy's running for for a political office that is absolutely drenched and submersed in foreign policy concerns. And so what do you think would happen in the first meeting with President Gary Johnson and the National Security Council? Is He would quickly find out that he was being shouted down by people who knew a whole lot more about foreign policy than he does. He wouldn't have really any information to fall back on. He wouldn't be able to assert himself in these meetings. And unless he fired absolutely everyone in the entire foreign policy apparatus, which he could never get away with doing, he would be constantly surrounded by people who knew many times more than he did about foreign policy at all. So how was he going to convince anybody to go along with that? The presidency is not really this whole thing where you show up one day and you can just do whatever you want now. There's this gigantic bureaucracy which puts up huge resistance to any attempts at major change. This was even true historically for absolutist monarchs, right? You can't just come in and do whatever you want, even though you theoretically have untrammeled power. So the whole Washington apparatus would really be in control because he wouldn't know anything with which to counter their thoughts. So it's important to actually know something about this stuff. And that's why Ron Paul was always good, is Ron Paul actually did know a lot about this, and he always made very good comments on foreign policy. And contributed a lot, I think, in saying sane things that had to be said. And it wasn't too long ago that his comments from 10 years ago about Afghanistan were being recirculated on YouTube and other places because, of course, he was right, as many, many people were about Afghanistan who were opposed to the liberal hegemony agenda there. But if you don't know anything about it, I mean, he could have never made that speech if... he said, where is Afghanistan? What is Afghanistan? I don't know anything about it. I just know we should leave it alone, right? Well, then that's it. That's the end of your ability to make any comments on the matter. And that has its place, but I'm not sure that it gets you very far in Washington.
Yeah, I was actually working on the foreign policy team at the Charles Koch Institute when he made that gaffe. And he had actually... I'm pretty sure this was like talked about in the papers. He had actually been getting briefings from people at Cato on like policy, and foreign policy was part of that. And so many people I knew in DC were just like, oh God, you know, like this is embarrassing, you know, and which kind of leads to what you were saying. The foreign policy establishment is very much in favor of intervening everywhere all the time. And as much as people might dislike engaging in like the policy process, it is really important. And a perfect example of this is the Trump administration, where Donald Trump talked a good game during the campaign. I mean, during the debate, it was really great when he was like, the Iraq war was a dumb mistake. You know, it's like, well, that's encouraging to hear. And then he, you know, wins. And then it's kind of like, what next? He picks really terrible people to staff executive positions, John Bolton, Nikki Haley, that random anonymous guy who was writing in the New York Times about undermining him. And now, General Milley, the Joint Chief of Staff, has done lots of terrible things. And now, you know, if Bob Woodward's book is correct, he was literally seizing control of the military from beneath Trump and everything. It's like Trump's the one who nominated him. So it's kind of like, one, Trump just and his team picked terrible people. But part of the reason they pick terrible people is because there's not many non-terrible people to pick from. I mean, the executive branch is massive, and all the national security, you know, bureaucracies, they're giant too. Even if Trump and his people had scraped together, you know, every, you know, person who had some restraint orientation and some kind of inkling of international relations theory, that he still would have been operating with a skeleton crew, as it were. And it'd be very difficult to get through his agenda through the bureaucracy. So I would pitch, if there's any any listeners, you know, in college or thinking about college, or their kids or grandkids are thinking about college, that, you know, totally transforming the foreign policy status quo of the United States is going to be a very long and drawn out process, but it can make a huge difference, a literal life and death difference. And so I'd encourage people to consider studying that. And fortunately, as you noted, Ryan, realism is not exactly ascendant, but it is becoming more prominent when it comes to the policy world. I'm right now participating in a fellowship with the John Quincy Adams Society, which is a student, like a student group that was founded just a few years ago, that is very restraint oriented. And so they'd be great to get in touch with if you're interested in doing this. There's now the Quincy Institute, which was kind of co-founded by the Koch Institute and George Soros, actually, and they've been garnering more attention, especially with the Afghanistan disaster. More realists and restrainers have kind of made a beachhead at the Atlantic Council, which, until they arrived there, I mean, it was just kind of this crazy interventionist place, and it still is. And there's kind of funny articles out there about how people despise it's a bunch of former Cato people are there now, kind of advocating for realism and restraint. So things are happening, and it's just kind of it's going to go pretty slowly, but I would encourage people to consider taking it up if they're interested in kind of a Sisyphean task, but it's definitely worth the effort for just the reasons you were laying out.
Yeah, and I think just to wrap up, I mean, just maybe briefly look at some of the things that I think you could have some common cause with some of these realists on. I think in terms of theory, you can get some shelter there, some help in terms of really understanding, providing, I think, a better understanding of how states actually behave rather than thinking that all the world is ripe for American invasion. But on just the applied policy level, I think if you wanted to find a good summary, I think, of what some of the policies are here, I think you do go to Posen's book on this. And you find, I think, some pretty decent suggestions that at least move in the right direction. And this actually, you find, one of the things that really stuck out to me was something that has a long history within the laissez-faire movement in general, and that is reducing your large standing land-based military in favor of a more maritime strategy. Now, of course, this is more geared toward countries that could get away with a more maritime strategy. You can't, if you're the Czech Republic, I suppose your maritime strategy is pretty limited. But if you're England or you're the United States, a maritime strategy can work very well, and you can actually find security, according to Posen, and certainly I'm sympathetic to the idea, that you can drastically reduce your army personnel. And in the case of the U.S. Army, I think this should be way, way cut back. Heck, in my more radical moments, which let's just say I'm having one right now, I think that the permanent standing army should just be abolished entirely. And in terms of actual territorial land-based military forces, it should really rely on, as I've noted in other articles, a decentralized militia system. But that's something else entirely from the Navy, which even Richard Cobden thought the Navy was fine because, of course, the Navy was really important for actually defending your maritime borders and your shipping and that sort of thing and dealing with piracy. Yes, there are absolutely private sector solutions to this is explored in some articles on Mises.org, but just assuming the existence of a state military, the Navy is really qualitatively different from a standing army that has the potential to invade and occupy cities either domestically or in a foreign setting. And that's, of course, obviously can be a real threat to your domestic population. And the Navy's a bit different on that, although they, of course, have cruise missiles and they can destroy things. But occupation force, occupation capability is not there. And so I like how Posen has that in terms of cutting way back on the Army, focusing more on a maritime strategy, overall cutting back spending down to 2.5% of overall of the GDP. And that is, I think, too large a number, of course, but cutting it down from 4% or 3.5%, which has been a pretty general and common number in the last 20 years, that would, of course, constitute cutting back $200 billion, $300 billion from the Pentagon's budget and from the intelligence budget. That's all. That would all be great progress. And again, no one could accuse these people then of saying, well, you just want the Russians to invade America. No, these people are just recognizing, as you say, Zachary, that the United States has perhaps never been safer and more secure than it is now in terms of its military. But that's not because of the Army. It's not because it spends so much on all these military adventures abroad. It's the nuclear arsenal, which ensures that any other state that launches a nuke of the U.S. will be completely destroyed. It's the Navy. And those are your major factors in there. And that doesn't require $700 billion of spending a year and then some, with it only going up in the near future.
And you might, listeners might even be surprised to learn that your view is, it is definitely a minority in DC policy circles, but that it actually exists. Why do we need such a large standing army? We could probably do away with most of it. John Mueller, who's a professor at, I think, Ohio University. I don't know if it's Ohio State, but and is a senior fellow at Cato. He has a chapter in a recently released book called Grand Strategy in the 21st Century, I think, that was put together by Cato, where he's like, you know, we're so secure and so safe. We don't need, you know, this giant standing army that's a threat to domestic liberty, for one thing, and costs a gajillion dollars. And he says, the way he puts it is, the only existential external threat to the United States is a super Hitler, and a super Hitler will not emerge overnight. So it would be really great if in 20 or 30 years, there's a bunch of Rothbardians running around, you know, the DC think tank circuit kind of making that case. But yeah.
Well, then on that note, I know one book that you've mentioned in conversations recently, Ryan, that kind of, again, something more familiar to the Mises audience, Hans Hermann Hoppe's collection that he edited, The Myth of National Defense, that might have some overlap there, you know, within our orbit on some of the issues that are relevant to these conversations.
Well, there's a good chapter in there on nuclear arms and their effect and on proliferation, and whether the United States needs to be invading other countries to prevent proliferation. Lots of good game theory in that. And so I would recommend that article. There's some good articles, too, on the issue of secession and the role of guerrilla forces. And I think these all just take pretty good, hard-headed views at military realities and assuming the existence of the state. So it doesn't rely on this view of, well, once you abolish the state always and everywhere, then we'll finally have peace. Well, That provides me not much of a roadmap to improving the world. But I think by using some of the good research that's put out there by IR researchers and so on, and I'm glad you mentioned Mueller there. I think he's got some good thinking on a variety of topics. I think we can really improve the situation in terms of using the information that's available to construct a better anti-interventionist position. So with that, I think we should wrap up. I want to thank Zachary a lot for joining us today, and also to Tho Bishop, who always is good at bringing, I think, a deeper knowledge of what's going on in the movement than I have. I don't think I keep up enough with that side of things.
For better or for worse.
So thank you both for joining me today, and we'll be back in the future with another episode of Radio Rothbard. See you next time.